Thanks very much, Peter. Thanks very much, John Harris, for the invitation. Thanks, Ivan Deveson, for talking to me about, not exactly about Jesuit matters, but certainly about matters social and theological. John, I agree with Peter that you don't really understand the Jesuits, and if you did, you wouldn't have made that comment. I can recall being at a Jesuit function at one stage, and the MC got up and addressed brother Jesuits of all faiths and none. So the fact of the matter is that particular order is a remarkably broad church in itself. Peter, yes, I have been the health minister now for over 3.5 years. My understanding is that the average length of tenure for federal health ministers is just under 2 years. So I guess I have been health minister now for much longer than the average, and it does give you a little perspective, but there is a sense in which the more things change, the more things stay the same, the longer you last, the more, in a sense, some of your initial views are confirmed. Before I became the health minister, I was called up by a journalist. It was in the middle of the 2001-2004 parliamentary term. Speculation was rife then, as in subsequent times, about whether or not the Prime Minister would stay. And some mischievous journalist said to me, try to get me to, in a sense, feed this speculation, said, look, is there any other portfolio that you would rather be in? At that stage, I was Minister for Workplace Relations. And I said, no, of course there's not. I love workplace relations. It's a marvellous portfolio. It's full of politics, it's full of economics, it's full of human drama and interest. And then, as an aside, I said, I could be in health, for instance, which is hasn't got a drop of ideological conflict in it, and is 99% an argument over resource allocation. Well, of course, a couple of months later, I, in fact, found myself in health. And look, I was right in the sense that there is an enormous amount of discussion in health about resource allocation. I was wrong that there is no intellectual or philosophical or indeed ideological content in all of that. Values do matter in health as in other portfolios. And I want to talk to you in part today about the competing values at issue in our contemporary health debate. But I do have a scripted speech. And if you don't mind, that is what I will now deliver. After all, this is CEDA, the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia, and John Harris did assure me that some of the finest minds in the great city of Melbourne would be listening to me. So I have got a scripted speech. Judging by Peter Costello's budget speech and Kevin Rudd's response, the government is clearly more interested in health policy than the opposition, because the Treasurer devoted a section of his nationally televised budget address to health, unlike the opposition leader, who had nothing to say in an area always assumed to be Labor's strong point. Based on the relative attention provided to it in Budget Week, the Howard government is entitled to keep claiming that it is the best friend that Medicare has ever had. In announcing Medicare-funded dental treatment for the chronically ill, better specialist care for people with multiple conditions, and more help for Aboriginal health, the Treasurer underlined the difference between government, which can deliver, and opposition, which can just talk. For more than a decade, the Howard government has not just been talking about Medicare, but spending the money needed to make a good system even better. Last week's budget contained $4.6 billion in new spending, lifted federal health and ageing spending to almost $52 billion in the coming year, and increased broadly defined health spending to nearly 22% of the federal budget. This compares to just 14% in 1996. Still, the government is not just increasing spending, it's delivering better health outcomes. Between 1996 and 2004, for instance, life expectancy increased by 3 years for Australian men and by 2 years for women. As well, the long-term growth of the federal health budget is now expected to moderate with forecast mid-century spending reducing from 8.1% to 7.3% of GDP in the second intergenerational report, thanks in part to cost-effectiveness measures increasingly applied to new spending. Of course, even very good health systems never quite meet the expectations of the public, who tend to want the best immediately for free. There could always be more doctors or other health professionals in hard-to-service places. For some patients, PBS drugs will always take too long to be evaluated. Almost by definition, the gap between what's possible and what's available is always too wide. Even the most diligent and best-trained health professionals occasionally make mistakes. Even so, it's easier to see how Australian health systems could be worse than to be sure how they could dramatically be improved without abolishing scarcity or human frailty. Hence the essentially bipartisan agreement, at least between the Prime Minister and the Labor Premiers, that Australia has the world's least imperfect health systems. These days, as elsewhere, the federal opposition tends to attack the government for failing to achieve Olympian standards rather than for actually mismanaging federal programs. Often, it seems, problems presided over by the states, like elective surgery waiting lists, have become the federal government's fault. The federal government is now allegedly to blame for problems that people often create for themselves, such as lifestyle conditions like obesity. In fact, criticising a government which is largely on top of its own responsibilities for not also shouldering the responsibilities of others is a form of backhanded compliment. It's second nature for state governments under pressure to blame the federal government for their failures, but recently there have been subtle changes in state politicians' instinct to blame Canberra. Once, Canberra was typically at fault for blocking state initiatives. These days, Canberra is more likely to be blamed for not taking enough initiative itself, for not showing enough leadership in areas that used to be the preserve of the states. This so-called leadership invariably means giving the states more money to do better what they are currently not doing well. In health, as elsewhere, the federal opposition has joined this charade, now regularly attacking the government for not saving the states from themselves. The opposition wants to end the blame game, it says, but only by blaming everything on the Howard government. The new tactic is to devise a wish list and to accept no explanation when the federal government can't immediately deliver. A consequence of booming employment is temporarily lower labour productivity. Why hasn't the federal government fixed this? Not that Mr Rudd can ever explain how restoring union power would make workers more productive. A consequence of a strong economy is shortages in key trades. Why hasn't the federal government fixed those? Not that Mr Rudd has ever explained why creating trade workshops in every school, whether or not they need them, really is such a good idea. In health, Labor's criticism is that the Howard government hasn't fixed elective surgery waiting lists, even though the states run public hospitals and have benefited from a 16% real increase in federal hospital funding. Labor argues that the Howard government hasn't fixed the state's public dental waiting lists, even though during the life of the Keating government's dental scheme, when Mr Rudd was helping to run Queensland, people still waited up to 3 years for public dental treatment. Labor claims that chronic disease has been neglected, even though last year Medicare funded 650,000 GP care plans for people with chronic disease, 250,000 team care plans, and 285,000 comprehensive health checks. Labor complains that the government is neglecting disease prevention, even though it has lifted vaccine spending more than tenfold since 1996 and boosted immunisation rates from 53 to 90%. Finally, Labor affects dismay at rising out-of-pocket costs for medical services that aren't bulk billed, even though it still hasn't repudiated its former policy to abolish the extended Medicare safety net, which is helping people to cope with these out-of-pocket expenses. Of course, it's easy to identify possible areas for improvement, but much harder to demonstrate how these improvements might actually be made without blowing the budget, rewarding failure, or depriving people of their right to make choices, even sometimes unhealthy ones. Labor's critique lacks credibility without detailed costed policy to support its wish list. Under Julia Gillard and Mark Latham, Labor had Medicare Gold, a clear alternative policy, albeit one Labor's then national president described as a turkey. Nicola Roxon seems to think that it's enough to want better health outcomes without explaining how to bring them about. Her appointment seems to have marked a conscious decision to downgrade health policy. Perhaps it's not surprising that Labor should have all but given up on health when bulk billing, for instance, once Labor's policy touchstone, is now at an all-time high for GPs and specialists. While health seems to have lost some intensity as a political issue at the federal level, there are still very instructive differences between the ways the parties approach it. Take dentistry. There are thought to be 650,000 people currently on public dental waiting lists around the country. At the Westmead Dental Hospital in New South Wales, for instance, patients with no false teeth and no teeth of their own are supposed to be treated within 3 months. Even this hardly seems adequate, but according to documents provided to the New South Wales opposition, people without teeth are currently waiting nearly 2.5 years for treatment. The states will never take their responsibilities seriously if the federal government steps in whenever there's trouble. Even so, Federal Labor's response has been to promise an extra $100 million a year, presumably so the states can employ more public sector dentists to reduce these waiting times. But even if the states guarantee not to cut their own dental spending in return, a federal government has no way to ensure this happens. Of course, under the Keating scheme, many patients were given vouchers to seek treatment from private dentists. Similarly, under Medicare Gold, patients over 75 were supposed to receive free treatment in private hospitals rather than languish on public hospital waiting lists. By contrast, Labor's new draft health platform, prepared for its recent national conference, seems to rule out any significant use of the private sector to deliver health services currently provided in the public sector. I quote, "Labor opposes the privatisation of public hospitals," it declares, "amongst other reasons because," and I quote, "it does not lead to increased efficiency, allows financial incentives to influence admission, treatment and hospital discharge patterns, and reduces government control over the quality of services." This would seem to threaten the continued delivery of public hospital services should Labor negotiate the next healthcare agreements by such famous institutions as St Vincent's in Sydney and Melbourne, the Mater in Brisbane and Calvary in Canberra, let alone the use of private hospitals and private dentists to reduce public waiting lists. Labor's ideological commitment to big government seems no less instinctive in health than in industrial relations. It's noteworthy that in some 25 pages of draft health policy, including a specific section on private health insurance, there's no mention of the rebate that makes private cover affordable. Labor says it believes in the rebate, but not enough apparently to put it in the national platform. Without the rebate, health cover would cost families an extra $1,000 a year, a risk of RUD premium in the health sector too. Similarly, there's no explicit support for the fee-for-service principle, but much public criticism of doctors' charges, even though this is essential for the independence of the medical profession. On the evidence of its draft platform and public commentary, any pre-election commitments it might make to the rebate as to privately run health institutions will be as plausible as any reassurances it might give over individual contracts in the mining industry. The Coalition's very different approach to dentistry is emblematic of its different attitude to the states, to the private sector, and to the usefulness of market mechanisms, even in a sector as dominated by government as health. In last week's budget, the government totally recast the provision for Medicare-funded dental services for people with chronic disease. Instead of 3 consultations with a private dentist, rebated at just under $80 each, from November the 1st there will be 1 Medicare-funded initial consultation plus up to $2,000 a year of Medicare-funded dental treatment. It's likely that these dental rebates will broadly mirror the long-standing and successful arrangements for treating veterans. The new arrangement is estimated to cost $378 million and to help 200,000 people over 4 years. It will help many of the people on the state dental waiting lists, such as the old age or disability pensioners, who often have chronic disease and complex care needs. And like all Medicare-funded services, it will be delivered in accordance with clinical eligibility rather than a limited budget. The government is not assuming the dental responsibilities of the states, but better discharging its existing responsibilities under Medicare. It's not doing the state's job for them, but doing its own job better. The government is not establishing another public provider, but working through private dentists operating on a fee-for-service basis, even when they choose to bulk bill. Provided a patient has a referral to a named dentist from a specific GP, there's no reason why Medicare-funded dental services could not be delivered by a government employee, in much the same way that staff specialists currently deliver Medicare-funded public hospital outpatient services. It's the quality of the service provision, not the nature of the service provider, that matters to the Howard government. For all its talk about service delivery, Labor's record and draft platform suggests that it barely tolerates health services delivered by the private sector. Under the former Labor government, there was no support for private health insurance. Systems were designed in ways to make bulk billing all but mandatory. This is hardly surprising, given the historical role of unions in running the Labor Party, including the Health Services Union, which has given Labor nearly $500,000 over the past 3 years. But it's not well suited to evolving health systems, with nearly 60% of all procedures now performed in private hospitals. For Labor MPs and the academics they listen to, the UK National Health Service, which still comprises about 80% of the British health sector, remains the acme of health systems. Effective management of the federal government's health responsibilities can never be taken for granted. The challenges of the next few months include finalising the PBS reform legislation, finally starting to provide Medicare rebates online from doctor surgeries, further boosting levels of informed financial consent for private hospital procedures, working with the states and territories to establish national registration boards to achieve uniform high national standards for health practitioners, and above all, preparing to renegotiate the healthcare agreements. The next agreements should focus on improving service delivery in state health systems rather than providing hospital funding to state treasuries, which is why the government is considering making more use of the Medicare benefit schedule in preference to block grants. In health, as elsewhere, people know where they stand with the Howard government. The government has diligently tackled emerging problems, wherever possible, building on the strengths of existing systems and respecting the professionalism of the people who make them work. It's worth posing the question: how many people would like the existing state governments to run Medicare rather than have the existing federal government take over public hospitals? That this is government policy. But if state Labor can't run public hospitals effectively, why should a very inexperienced, accident-prone and ideologically rigid federal Labor team be trusted with the overall management of Australia's health system? I think that's a question which is certainly worth pondering. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for having me, and I do look forward to the discussion.